Chapter 25. Barak and I walked back to Chancery Lane. I was bone-tired, the stitches in my arm tweaking and pulling.
"We should have a few hours' sleep when we get back," Barak said.
In the moonlight, he too looked exhausted.
"There's Adam Kite's case tomorrow, then Smithfield with Arsenet, then the Dean."
He groaned at the thought of it all. We walked on in silence for a while. Then Barak said,
"That poor ass old Yarrington will let you, eh?"
He sounded almost back to his usual mocking self, perhaps glad to be dealing with ordinary human weaknesses again after the horror at the church.
"Yes, and the killer knew that somehow."
"How?"
"I don't know. If we can find out, we may have him."
"What will he do next?"
"It's impossible to say. As Hartford said, the fifth prophecy is vague."
"What do you think those people are hiding, Lockley and the Dean?"
"They're hiding something."
"Yes, they are. We must find out tomorrow."
"Do you think they were part of some nest of sodomites? The monasteries were full of those filthy creatures."
"I don't know. Lockley certainly didn't strike me as being inclined that way."
"You can't always tell."
"You sound as fierce against sin as Harsnet." He grinned.
"Only sins I don't feel drawn to myself," he said with a flash of his old humour. "'Tis always easier to condemn those."
We arrived back at Chancery Lane. "I must go and see that boy Timothy first thing," I said wearily. Behind a window I saw a lamp raised, Harsnet's man Orr on watch.
"What if he makes a run for it in the night?"
"He won't run. I told you, he needs a new place."
"And how are you going to conjure that out of thin air for him?"
"I have an idea. I won't let him down.
Now, come, I'm too tired to talk more.
We need a few hours' sleep or we shall be seeing double tomorrow." When we reached home, I asked Barak to have me wakened no later than first light, and wearily mounted the stairs to bed. Exhausted as I was, I couldn't sleep. Lying in bed in the darkness, I kept turning Yarrington's terrible death over in my mind, trying to fit it into the pattern of the others. At length I got up, threw my coat over my nightshirt, and lit a new beeswax candle. The yellow glow spreading from my table over the room was somehow comforting. I sat at the table thinking. I was sure the killer had been there when we got Adam down from London Wall. Yarrington had been there too. Was that when the killer had decided that Yarrington would be his next victim? No, that spectacle had been planned a long time, and Yarrington's fornication with that poor girl had been known to the killer. But how, when the cleric had kept it so secret? It hadn't been a matter of common knowledge like Rogers and Dr. Gurney's turning away from radical reform or poor Tupholm's noisy affair with Welsh Elizabeth. It was important to see that boy tomorrow, find out if he knew anything. I hadn't seen nearly enough evidence to be sure that Goddard was the killer. But if not Goddard, then who was he, this man who knew about medicine and the law and mixed, or had mixed recently, with the radical sectaries? I wondered uneasily whether Harsnet was pressing the radical reformers enough for information. He would be far gentler with his own people than with Abigail. The old law book was on my desk. I had borrowed it from the library. I opened it again to the case of Stroder, smelling dust and ancient ink again. Stroder, too, must have planned his killings with care to go undetected for years. I read again how he refused to say anything at his trial, but that he had often raged most obscenely against the wicked trade of whores. Did our killer, too, somehow believe he was doing God's work? Or was it all some terrible game? Or were both the same in his unfathomable mind? I remembered the German Anabaptists who, in overthrowing society in Munster, believed that in their violence they were pushing forward God's will, bringing Armageddon about all the faster. Perhaps the killer believed each step was a symbolic fulfillment of the Revelation prophecies that he would bring about the end of the world. I resolved to talk to Guy again. At last, I fell asleep. I was still deeply asleep when Joan knocked gently at the door. I rose slowly, my back stiff and sore, although my arm ached less. I decided to leave off the sling. I went to the window and looked out. The sky was lightning, clear and blue, with light fluffy clouds. For the first time in several days, I did my back exercises, grunting as I twisted and stretched. Then I dressed and went downstairs. I scratched at my stubbly cheeks, conscious I needed a visit to the barber. In the parlour, Barrack, dressed in his shirt and upper hose, was already breakfasting on bread and cheese and wizened apples.
"Last year's apple crop is drying out quickly," he said.
"I'll get Peter to open a new barrel. They'll be fresher."
"Is your arm better?"
"Yes, it is today."
"Young Piers did a good job, then."
I pulled the loaf towards me.
"Is Tamasin not yet up?"
"Just. She's getting lazy."
I looked at him, and he reddened.
"Her bruises are going down, and her mouth is healing, but she still doesn't like to be seen. She'll be all right in another day or two. She's still furious about that tooth drawer asking her to sell him her teeth."
"She could have been killed that night," I said seriously. "And it happened because of our work. My work." Barrack put down the remains of his apple. He was silent a moment, then said,
"I hate this job. Chasing after this lunatic or devil-possessed man or whatever he is. I suppose I've been taking it out on Tamasin."
He shifted uncomfortably. "Why?" I asked gently.
"Because she's there, I suppose. It's no way to treat your wife, I know."
I asked quietly, "Do you still want her for your wife?"
"Of course I do."
He glared at me and I wondered if I'd gone too far, but then he sighed and shook his head.
"I know I've been a churl, but..."
He ran his fingers through his thick, untidy brown hair.
"Somehow you get into a way of behaving and it's hard to get out of it."
He sighed again.
"But when all this is over, I've decided to leave the old barge and see if I can't find a decent little house for us to rent nearer to Lincoln's Inn."
I smiled. "That's marvellous news. Tamasin will be so pleased."
"But I'm going to stay home more. Spend less time in the, taverns."
His hesitation made me wonder if Tamasin's suspicions had been right and he had been seeing other women.
"Have you told her?"
I asked.
"Nah, I'll wait till things have settled down a bit."
"But you should tell her now."
He frowned. I realised I'd gone too far.
"I'll tell her when I think it's right," he said brusquely. "I'll get dressed and then I'll tell Peter to get Suki and Genesis saddled and ready."
He got up and went out. His mention of Peter reminded me of my promise to the boy Timothy. I paused to eat some bread and cheese, slipped one of the wrinkled apples into my pocket and went to the kitchen. There I found Joan and Tamasin. Tamasin was sitting at the table slicing vegetables for the evening meal. Her bruises were less puffy now, but still horridly colourful, red and black, and her face was still swollen. Joan looked up at me and smiled, but Tamasin put a hand up to hide her face. Joan was washing, bent over a large wooden bucket. Her face, surrounded by her white coif, was red, and she kneaded the wet fabric. I reflected with a pang of guilt that she was near 60 now. Her late husband had once been my steward, and when he died 15 years ago,
I'd kept her on as housekeeper. It was an unusual arrangement for a single man, despite the difference in our ages, but I'd always liked her quiet, motherly ways. I'd been going to ask her if she knew of any help that might be needed in the houses nearby, but last night a new idea had occurred to me. "I wonder, Joan," I said, "if you could use the help of another boy in the kitchen." She thought a moment. "Peter has a lot to do between the stables and helping me in here," she smiled tiredly. "But I don't know how he would take to having a second boy around." I smiled. "This boy is younger than Peter. We would make it clear he's the senior. I need to talk to this other boy some more, though. It would be good to have someone else, sir." "Then I'll see what I can do today." "Thank you," she said gratefully. She lifted the bucket of clothes in their dirty water and headed for the yard. Tamsin rose and opened the door for her, then returned to the table. "Your bruises seem better, Tamsin."
"They're still a dreadful sight, sir, but I suppose they'll be gone soon."
"How's your mouth?"
"I have little pain there now. The tooth drawer was good after all."
"Guy wouldn't have recommended someone who didn't know his work."
"I still can't believe he offered to buy my teeth, take them all out. I'd be a hideous sight."
Her tone was sad, drained of emotion. She looked at me.
"What happened last night? Jack wouldn't tell me anything when he came in. Just told me to go back to sleep."
"He wouldn't have wished you to worry, Tamsin. I'm afraid there's been another killing." Her eyes widened.
"Were you and Jack in danger?"
"No. No, we found the body."
"Will this never end?" she asked. "It's having a bad effect on Jack. On you too, sir. I can see that."
Then she gave a sardonic smile that made her seem years older.
"Or maybe I mistake the fact that Jack is tired of me for the effect on him of hunting this brute."
"You still love him?" I asked directly.
"Yes," she answered quickly. "But I won't go on like this forever. I won't be ground down to powder as some women are."
I smiled. "It was your spirit that attracted him to you in York. I know that."
She ventured a smile in reply, but it still held a sardonic edge.
"Not my pretty face?"
"Not that it's pretty now." "Your pretty face as well. And it will heal. Tamsin, perhaps I shouldn't tell you this, but I will. Jack still loves you. He knows he hasn't been behaving as he should. He's told me that when this is over, he will move you out of the barge to a good house."
"He said that?"
"Yes, on my honour. But in confidence, you mustn't tell him what I've said."
She frowned.
"But why did he not tell me?"
"He only told me because I was goading him. You know what he's like."
"Do I? I thought I knew him."
"Give him time, Tamsin. I know he can be difficult, but..."
"Give him time."
She looked at me seriously.
"I will, but not forever,"
she said quietly.
"Not forever."
The yard door opened and Joan returned, holding the bucket to her hip.
"I'd better go to the stables," I said. "Jack'll be wondering what has happened to me. We have some visits to make this morning."
"Think of what I've said, Tamsin." She nodded and smiled. I went out to the stables where Barrack was talking to Harsnett's man Orr, who straightened his cap as I approached. I liked him. He was quiet, watchful, unobtrusive. "A quiet night?" I asked him.
"Yes, sir."
I looked at Barrack, feeling a sudden rush of irritation. How could a man be so foolish as to go into a prolonged sulk for that was how it seemed, with a woman of Tamsin's qualities. If it had been me and Dorothy... I suppressed the thought. Ready? I asked briskly. Then let's get going. We rode back through the city to Yarrington's house. The horses plodded along contentedly. When we reached our destination, we tied Suki and Genesis up outside, and I feared for a moment the boy had run off after all. If so, my softness might have lost us vital evidence. But Timothy was in the stable, sitting on his bucket beside the horse. He'd been crying again. There was a bubble of snot at one nostril. "Good morning, Timothy," I said gently. "This is my assistant, Barrack." He stared at us with frightened eyes.
"It's cold in this stable," Barrack said gruffly.
Timothy would remind him of his own urchin childhood. "I have a position for you," I told the child. "Working in my house. Kitchen and stable work. How would you like that?"
"Thank you, sir," he brightened. I'll do my best."
I took a deep breath. "There is a condition, though."
"A what, sir?"
"Something you must do for me. You must tell me something. Yesterday you said that you told no one about Abigail."
"No, sir. I didn't.
But he reddened, squirmed uneasily on the bucket. The horse, sensitive to changes of mood, turned and looked at him. "But there's something else, isn't there?" He hesitated, looked between me and Barrack.
"Come on, lad," Barrack urged.
"I promise you Abigail will come to no harm," I added. "But I think there's something more you didn't tell me." Timothy breathed hard, the snot quivering at his nostril.
"Tell us, lad," Barrack said. "Master Shardlake's house is warm. You'll like it there."
"I watch people,"
the boy blurted out suddenly. He pointed to a knothole in the stable door.
"Through there. I get tired of being in here all the time."
"Master Toby didn't let you out much?"
"Only to help clean the house. I'm sorry if it was wrong, looking."
"What did you see?" I asked quietly.
"Tradesmen who called. The eggman, the chimney sweep, and the carpenter to repair the wooden screen when Toby knocked it over. But that was before Abigail came."
"And after?"
"A man used to come and see Abigail sometimes, when the master was out and Toby had his day off. Toby didn't know about it."
He bowed his head. "Who was he?" I asked.
"Don't know."
He shook his head. "Did he come often?"
"A few times. This winter, when there was snow on the ground."
"Was he a tall man? A gentleman?" I asked, thinking of Goddard.
"No, sir."
Timothy shook his head again.
"He was young."
"How young?" He thought for a moment.
"I don't know. Maybe 20?
"What did he look like?"
"Taller than either of you. Strong looking like him."
He pointed to Barrack.
"Fair or dark?" "Dark. He was handsome. Abigail used to say he had a handsome face."
"She talked to you about him?" I tried to keep a tremor of excitement from my voice.
"Not much, sir. I told her I'd seen him. She said the less I knew, the less I could tell. She didn't like me knowing."
"So he used to visit her secretly?"
"Yes."
"Did she know him before she came here?"
"I don't know,"
Timothy said again.
"Honestly, sir, I don't know that."
"Was he in the Reverend's congregation?" I asked.
"Don't know, sir. I only saw him because he came round the back door when Master was out. Please?
He began to look upset.
Please, sir. I've told you all I know.
All right, I said. Thank you, Timothy.
Now, come. You're coming back with us.
Barak, take my papers on to court. I'll join you there after I've delivered Timothy home. He looked dubious.
Shouldn't you clear it with Arsnet before taking him?
No.
Timothy's master is dead and I'm buying his services.
I leaned close to Barak. And I want him kept safe at my house. He may be the only one that's seen the killer and lived.
Whoever he was trying to describe, it doesn't sound like Goddard.
No. I nodded and looked at him. It doesn't, does it? Timothy had got to his feet. He laid a hand on the horse's flank.
Please, sir, may I take Dinah too?
I'm sorry, lad, no. We already have two horses.
He bit his lip.
I thought the horse and Abigail are probably the only friends he's ever had.
But I couldn't take another horse I didn't need. Barak reached out a hand.
Come on, Sniffly, he said kindly. Let's get you home and safe.